Okay, good evening, everybody. So, this evening we'll continue going through the Bodhisattva vows like we did last time, but we will, of course, start with our practice, meditating on the Buddha, and before that, calm our mind with a little bit of breathing meditation, prepare the mind to be able to listen to the teachings. So, let's start with some silence, let the mind relax, and then we'll do the visualizations and the recitations. And in the space in front, visualize the Buddha, surrounded by the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, yourself surrounded by all the sentient beings. And make the whole visualization of the holy beings. They're all made of light. And think that they're looking at you with kindness and acceptance. Take refuge. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free of suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings not be separated from sorrowless bliss. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind, and present clouds of every type of offering, actual and mentally transformed. I confess all my destructive actions accumulated since beginning this time, and rejoice in the virtues of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until cyclic existence ends, and turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. I dedicate all the virtues of myself and others to the Great Awakening. This ground anointed with perfume, flower-strewn Mount Meru, for land, sun, and moon, imagined as a Buddha land and offered to you, may all beings enjoy this pure. Space of your truth body, from billowing clouds of your wisdom and love, let fall the rain of the profound and extensive Dharma in whatever form is suitable for subduing sentient beings. Glorious and precious root Guru, sit upon the lotus and moon seat on my crown, guiding me with your great kindness, bestow upon me the attainments of your body, speech, and mind. The eyes through whom the vast scriptures are seen, supreme doors for the fortunate who would cross over to spiritual freedom. Illuminators whose wise means vibrate with compassion, to the entire line of spiritual masters I make request. Haya Tao Mani Mani Maha Mani Asoha Taya Tao Mani Mani Maha Mani Asoha Taya Tao Mani Mani Maha Mani Soha Taya Tao Mani Mani Maha Mani Soha Taya Tao Mani Mani Maha Mani Soha Taya Tao Maha Muni Soha Taya Tao Muni Muni Maha Muni Soha. And while visualizing the Guru Buddha on your head, and also in the heads of all the sentient beings around you, then think, for the sake of all mother sentient beings, may I quickly attain complete and perfect Buddhahood. For that purpose, from now on, until I attain the essence of awakening, I shall keep the ethical code of the conqueror's children, train in their vast activities, and for the sake of all sentient beings attain Buddhahood. May I maintain this intention until I do indeed realize Buddhahood. All Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, please listen. just as the Sugatas of the past generated bodhicitta and trained step by step in the bodhisattva precepts. I too, for the sake of all sentient beings, will generate bodhicitta and train step by step in the bodhisattva precepts. Today my life has become fruitful. I have successfully attained a human life. Today I have been born into the Buddha's family and have now become a child of the Buddha's. From now on, whatever I do will be in harmony with that family. I will do nothing to taint this unsullied family. Then think in response to your requesting the Guru Buddha. Five colored light rays and nectar stream from all the parts of his body into you through the crown of your head. This is happening simultaneously with all the other sentient beings around you too. The light and nectar absorbs into your mind and body and into those of all sentient beings. It purifies all negativities, obscurations, accumulated since beginningless time. And it especially purifies all illness, interferences, negativities, and obscurations that interfere with training in the bodhisattva precepts once you've generated the wish for supreme awakening. Your body becomes translucent, the nature of light. And all your good qualities, lifespan, merit, and so forth expand and increase. Think in particular that a superior realization of training in the bodhisattva precepts once you have generated the bodhicitta has arisen in your mind stream and in the mind streams of others. So last week that question came up about wrong views, and I checked in Dapo Rinpoche's commentary on the Bodhisattva precepts, and he says that it's, you know, the same as the 10 non-virtuous paths of action. It's the same as the last one of wrong views. And he said, in general, wrong views means saying that what doesn't exist exists, or what does exist doesn't exist. Okay, that's in general what wrong views are. But here, it's specifically saying that what does exist doesn't exist. And he gave three instances of doing this. So it's like I explained last time, you know, saying the three jewels don't exist, saying the law of cause and effect doesn't exist, and saying there's no such thing as rebirth, no past and future lives. Okay, so negating those three are, you know, any of those three, that's the meaning of wrong views. Okay, so that's according to this precept, yeah. But then, you know, the question came up last week, what about somebody who thinks euthanasia is perfectly okay, and that it's fine to not only euthanize your pets, but euthanize, you know, human beings with assisted suicide. Yeah? I know it sounds strange to say assisted suicide is euthanasia, but it's, that's basically what it is, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah? So, you know, these are kind of hot political topics right now in the country. You know, but thinking that killing in that form is okay, or even for that matter, you know, going to war and killing is okay. You know, just really feeling there's nothing negative in that, there's no non-virtue, it's completely fine to do. Then, you know, I think in my thinking about it this last week, I would call that a wrong view, even though it may not fulfill the specific definition of this bodhisattva vow. Yeah? Because still, if you hold on to that kind of way of thinking, then, you know, the purpose of wrong views as being fulfilled is that, in that, you know, what they do is they make you create negative karma. Yeah? So you don't have to tell anybody else what your view is or try and convince anybody of it, but just having that wrong view ourselves. But in specific, in relationship to the ninth root bodhisattva precept, it's negating the existence of the three jewels of cause and effect, karma and its effects, or of past and future lives. Okay? Yeah. So that one and the last one of abandoning bodhicitta, you know, don't require the four binding factors. Yeah, just having that in your mind, it constitutes a transgression. Okay, so something to be careful of. So last week we went through the 18 root bodhisattva precepts, and then we started on the 46 auxiliary ones. Yeah, and so I explained how they are broken up according to different categories, according to the six far-reaching practices, and then a category at the end about benefiting sentient beings. Okay, so last time we went over the ones that were in the category of generosity. Yeah, so that have to do with not accepting others' generosity, not allowing them to create merit, or not being generous ourselves. Yeah. And then the second category was the ones regarding ethical conduct. So, you know, kind of, you know, not keeping your precepts well when you can, or, you know, being really mean to people who have broken their precepts. Okay, and then all sorts of things like that. Yeah. Okay, wrong livelihood, and so on. Okay, so now we'll start the one about the, to eliminate the obstacles to the far-reaching practice of fortitude. then there's four under this one. Okay, so it's number 17 of the 46. So it's returning insults, anger, beating, or criticism with insults and the like. So somebody insults us, and we insult them back. You're fat, so are you. Whatever, you know. You're short-tempered, so are you. Whatever, you know, you want to, you know. Or beating somebody, or anger, you know. You're mad at me, so I'm going to be mad at you. Yeah, returning anger with anger. Yeah. Or beating, you know. Somebody beats you. The cat goes, you know, and you go back to the cat. you know, so returning beating with beating. And then criticism. Somebody criticizes us, we criticize them back. Okay, somebody talks bad about us behind our back, we talk bad about them behind their back. And we say, oh, that's completely legitimate. They did it, so why can't I do it back to them?
Actually, it's even worse, isn't it? Because they say, speak badly about us from our back is because of their ignorance or something. But for us, it's on top of that, it's spiteful.
Right, exactly. So maybe they're speaking bad about us because of their ignorance or misunderstanding. But then when we speak bad about them, we're spiteful and we want revenge. So our motivation in some ways, you know, is quite definitely a negative motivation. Yeah. And often, you know, we think people are speaking badly about us, but they aren't. Yeah, our mind is seeing harm where there's no harm. Okay, so they say, these four come up in the Chenrezig practice, yeah, and a few other kind of situations, you know, and they're called the four ascetic practices. Mm-hmm. You know, we usually think of asceticism as, you know, you're refraining from eating and drinking and sleeping and all these kinds of things, which the Buddha says is that kind of asceticism is really rather useless. But this kind of asceticism is actually good. Somebody insults us, but we don't return the insult. Somebody, you know, beats us, we don't beat them, we don't engage physically with them. Somebody is angry with us, we don't bother to get angry back. Yeah. Somebody criticizes us, we don't criticize them back. So that's really a much higher level practice of restraint, isn't it? You know, and that kind of restraint is going to stop wars. Yeah. Not only international wars, but personal wars. Hmm? Okay, so building up some kind of inner strength so that when things happen that we don't like, we don't have to react to them immediately. This is where we get ourselves in trouble, you know? Something happens and it's like, I don't like this, I've got to tell that person right now that I don't like what they said, I don't like what they did, you know? And that impulsivity on our part, yeah, it often very much goes against this, yeah, because we wind up retaliating. Okay, 18, neglecting those who are angry with oneself by not trying to pacify their anger. Okay, all you people pleasers out here, this does not mean what you think it means. Okay, people pleasers hear this. And, oh, neglecting those who are angry with me by not trying to pacify their anger. I am responsible for their anger. I'm so bad because they're angry at me. I've got to make it so they're no longer angry. I've got to make them happy. I better go and, you know, apologize and do three somersaults and, you know, confess and make them happy and give them lollipops and chocolate cake and everything because their unhappiness is my fault. That is not what it says here, okay? What this means is if somebody is angry with us, you know, and they've misunderstood something, or they're suffering greatly by their anger, then to make an attempt to communicate with them to explain what the situation is. Okay? In other words, you know, instead of just saying, well, you know, forget them, to realize that, you know, if you're a bodhisattva and you want to benefit some people, if they're angry at you, it's going to be hard for you to benefit them, because they're going to reject everything you say. Whereas, you know, if they've misunderstood something, then if you can go and talk to them and help them to understand the situation, then again they will become more open and you'll be able to benefit them. Okay? So it means keeping the lines of communication open. Yeah? It does not mean going and taking all the blame on yourself and feeling guilty and pampering the person and treating them like they're a child, thinking, you know, because you feel so guilty, you know, it's like, oh, they're unhappy, they're angry, I've got to fix it. In some ways, I think that's very disrespectful of other people. You know, it's like saying, you're not an adult, you can't handle your own emotions. I've got to come and fix your problems for you. Yeah? So I think sometimes it's actually a way, we think we're offering sympathy, but it actually is a way of keeping the other person kind of bound in their role. Mm-hmm. So keep the channels of communication open, but you have to be truthful, you know, and honest. Yeah. So we accept responsibility for what is our responsibility, but we do not accept responsibility for what isn't. Yeah. Unless you think that the other person is like so hysterical and beyond control, that unless you, you know, do the three somersaults, they're going to jump off the diving board and land flat on their back in the water, you know, except in extreme situations, you know, I think we're just honest and, you know, and hopefully honesty is what pacifies people's problems, yeah? Okay.
Just asking whether the four ascetic practices, when you mentioned them coming up in Chenrezig practice, were you referring to the new name or?
Just when you hear teachings on the Thousand Arm Chenrezig, then it comes up in the context of the teachings. Yeah, I haven't seen it in the sadhana, but when they're talking about, you know, generating yourself as Chenrezig, clearly you need to practice these, don't you? Yeah. I'm Chenrezig, so I'm going to insult you back after you insulted me. And I'm going to clobber you after you clobbered me. And I'm really ticked off at you because you're ticked off at me. And, you know, you called me a name, so I'm going to call you a name too. You know, you can see why somebody can't be Chenrezig and do these four, you know. And so if we aspire to be Chenrezig, then we have to be able to control this part of ourselves. Okay? Yeah?
You called them the four ascetic practices. Is uh-huh. there another name they're referred to under?
There might be. I don't know. Yeah. Okay, number 19, refusing to accept the apologies of others. Okay? So somebody comes and they apologize, and we rub it in. Yeah? They say, I'm really sorry, you know, for what I did. And they're sincere. I'm not talking about phony baloney apologies, because phony baloney apologies aren't apologies. Yeah. But, some, you know, it's a sincere apology. But we say, after what you did to me, why should I forgive you? Do you know how much you hurt me? I could go into the whole dialogue. I have it memorized. Yes, I heard it quite a bit, actually. Yeah. So, you know, just rubbing it in more, retaliating. Somebody is sincerely sorry, and we go on and say something very hurtful and spiteful to them. Okay? So when somebody comes with a sincere apology, we should accept. Yeah? If it's an insincere apology, then just leave it aside, yeah? Okay. Then 20 is acting out thoughts of anger. Let's see, let's go on to the next one. Acting out thoughts of anger. Oh, but we don't have thoughts of anger, do we? We always have a good motivation. We never have a bad motivation. We're never angry at other people, are we? Yeah, we're just giving them feedback so they can improve. You know, because these poor things, they don't know how to do things correctly. And they make so many mistakes, and they do so many uncomfortable and inconvenient things. And it's really right that we give them feedback out of our great compassion for them so they can improve. Those dirty beep, 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 you know, with our angry mind waiting to, you know, say some sweet, kind words that we know is going to be like a knife. You know how to do that? Yeah? Because they're saying angry words, right? We all know how to say angry words. Yeah. Then somebody knows we're really mad. But sometimes we want to look sweet and innocent. Yeah. But we know what somebody's sensitive point is, don't we? Yeah. We know how to hurt them. We know how to offend them. So we just carry on a nice, sweet conversation. Just say something that we know that they happen to be very sensitive about, you know? And then they kind of look horrified and tear up or flare up, and we go, oh, but what's the matter with you? I didn't say anything. I only mean you well. I don't have any negative intention towards you. You're just projecting.
I'm too sensitive.
Yeah, and you're too sensitive. And inside we're going, ha, 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 I got them. Right? Oh, you all look so sweet. Okay.
Sorry, madam, but can we go back to the previous one? similar to the root vow,
yes.
The knot of breathing. But what
yeah.
is the difference?
What's the difference? Okay, if we look at the root vow.
Number 3.
Yeah. Okay. So it's not listening, although another declares his or her offense, and with anger, blaming them and retaliating. Okay, so this one's done with anger, and then you have to blame, and you have to retaliate. Yeah, the other one can be done with arrogance. You know, I am too good to accept your apology. You know, I am too high of a person to do that. Yeah. Or, you know, it could have any other kind of motivation. We're too lazy to, you know, say something, or we just brush it off. Yeah. They're looking for some sign that we've accepted their apology, and we just brush it off. Yeah.
The first one is with blame
and retaliation. Yeah. Yeah, and quite definitely anger. Okay. So, acting out thoughts of anger. Who, me? I'm not angry. That's another one we have. We don't see our anger. Yeah, we absolutely do not see our anger. And we think that what we're saying is like totally okay. We're totally out of touch with what's going on inside of ourselves. And sometimes, have you ever had the thing that sometimes you're meditating and you're remembering something that happened a year or two or three ago, and all of a sudden you realize what a horrible motivation you had then, but all that time in the middle you thought you had a very sweet motivation? You ever had that happen? Yeah? So sometimes we're just totally ignorant of our own motivation. And this can also go into the thing of, you know, when it says acting out thoughts of anger. Sometimes we show our anger by ridiculing somebody or making fun of them. And I'm not talking about harmless teasing or joking, although some people are extremely sensitive to that, in which case it's really better to abandon it. Even though, you know, for you it's just kind of fun. Some people are like, whoa, you know, they can't handle that kind of joking. Yeah, so, you know, to be aware of how our words or actions are affecting others. Okay, then, to eliminate obstacles to the far-reaching attitude of joyous effort, what we want to abandon is gathering a circle of friends or students because of one's desire for respect or profit. What's wrong with that? This is what people in general society do all the time. You butter people up so that you can get respect and profit. Yeah? I mean, isn't this what this whole thing about politics and the super PACs and all this stuff is about? Isn't this what lobbying is all about? Yeah? You butter people up so you can get something? Yeah? Isn't this, yeah. I mean, we do this all the time with people, don't we? We want something out of them. So we say something nice, or we give them a present, or do something nice. Huh? So what's wrong with it?
Dishonest.
What?
It's dishonest.
It's what?
Dishonest.
It's self-centered.
And it's self-centered. Do you think it damages the other person at all?
It's not the cop to realize that's what's going on. That's a huge trust.
Yeah, you know, they trust you, and then eventually they find out what's going on. Yeah, so it really damages people's trust.
We're seeing them as an object.
Yeah, yeah, we're seeing them as an object. Yeah, you have something to give. I can benefit from affiliation with you, and that's your purpose in the world. Nothing beyond that. Yeah, so it's really seeing the other person as an object, completely, you know, what I can get out of them. Okay, so gathering a circle of friends or students because of one's desire for respect or profit. Yeah. You know, you can read this and think, wow, who would ever do that? Yeah, but when especially, you know, this can actually be a problem with when monks come over from India or wherever and they're out of their community. There's no other, there's not two or three or four other monks with them. There's just them. And this group of, you know, wide-eyed, adoring Singaporeans or Westerners who are just, you know? And then you need to, you know, your monastery is expecting you to bring back donations, and they're also looking at you with adoring eyes that you start to feel, well, yeah, you know, in India I was nobody, but here I'm somebody, yeah? And I must be a really good teacher, because look at how all these people are acting towards me. Yeah? So it's a very difficult situation, you know, when people are out of their own community put in this kind of situation. And it can be easy for the mind slowly, gradually to shift. Yeah? Something to be careful about. Yeah, because you can see, it's like, you know, sometimes when you're first ordained, then people show you so much respect and you feel like, I don't deserve that, you know, I'm just little old me. But then after a while, you get used to people showing you respect, and then somebody comes along who doesn't, and you're like, mm-hmm. Boy, you're awfully rude. Mm-hmm. Kind of, don't you know who I am? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know. I'm an ordained member of the Sangha. You should do such and such and such to me. Yeah? Well, you're nodding your head, and you're not even a Sangha member.
I saw that before.
You've seen it before? Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. So as a lay person, how do we treat Sangha so that, I mean, all respect, but just in case that will we become like a cause for them to have peace?
I think if, you know, the question is about how lay people treat Sangha. I think sometimes people, in their effort to please, they spoil Sangha members, you know? Or sometimes people are taken in. For example, somebody in Singapore told me that one monk came and he's raising money for his monastery, and they so much wanted to help him raise the money for his monastery, they went completely out of their way and asked all their friends and got a lot of donations. And he was such a sweet, nice, wonderful monk, you know, and he needed a new watch. So they took him out to get a watch. So you might as well get him a good watch. They got him a gold Rolex, you know? And, you know, or whatever kind of watch they got him. I can't remember, but something like that. And he needs like a new jacket. So we want to create merit. We want to get him the best kind of jacket there is. And he needs a new pair of shoes, so we get this. And he likes going shopping, and he's so much fun to be with in the shopping center. He cracks so much jokes. And we love shopping anyway. We love to go shopping. We're Singaporean, it's in our blood. And, you know, let's go down to Orchard Road and, you know, and have a good time. And, you know, and just so eager to please, to create merit, to have a good time with a Sangha member, that they pamper, you know. And as it turned out with this particular monk, you know, he would go back and then he would come and they'd say, oh, please bring us pictures of your monastery in Tibet that you're rebuilding. And somehow he never had the pictures. Yeah? He forgot them, or they got ruined, or something. And then they figured out what was going on. Okay? So I'm not saying to be suspicious, but I have seen, and also in America too, people just really going overboard and spoiling the Sangha. You know? Yeah? Okay, somebody needs a new watch. Fine, you can get a cheap, simple one. Yeah? You don't need to get the, you know, give them. But sometimes people get into this thing of I want to be, you know, this is my way to be close to the teacher or close to the whoever it is, you know, I'm going to be the main benefactor. And so they love doing this kind of thing, and then of course they get the kind of, you know, status of being the main benefactor and get to eat dinner and this kind of stuff. Yeah. So, I mean, this way is so important, you know, to really always examine our mind. You know, both if you're a lay person and if you're a Sangha member. So as a lay person, you know, these lay people who do that, in some way they're trying, in some way they have a good motivation and they're trying to please. In another way, they're trying to get some ego status for themselves. So they're using the Sangha member, and the Sangha member is also using them. You know? So that's not Dharma. Okay? So I don't mean that you go to the other extreme and it's like, oh, you're a Sangha member and your robes are all falling apart. Too bad. I'm not going to, you know, give you any new robes. You know, forget it. Otherwise you'll get spoiled. You know, don't go to that extreme. Yeah?
Folks online have questions related to that.
Okay.
So not specifically about what you were saying, about checking your mind. So someone asked, how do we know for sure when our motivation is pure? What if we think it is, but it really isn't? And then another person said, yeah, I would like to know how to check myself.
Yeah. So this is really hard, you know? Like I said, I know for myself sometimes I thought I had a good motivation, and then later on, in really sitting with myself, I realized that there's some uncomfortable feeling inside, and I realized, no, my motivation was not very good. So I think that the way you learn to check yourself is through practice, you know, is through really sitting and feeling, like, what's the feeling in my gut? You know, because I know for myself when I have something's wrong with my motivation, there's a certain kind of internal feeling in my gut where it's like something doesn't feel right. Yeah, and so then I know, okay, it's time to stop and really check and see, okay, what's happening on the outside that I'm reacting to with some kind of non-virtuous thought here. Yeah? And so it's really just by practice, I think. You know? And I think also this is the benefit of doing a regular daily meditation practice, because when you meditate day to day, you look. When you first sit down to meditate, you check up kind of what's going on in your mind and what's the feeling in your mind. And so you learn to detect more quickly, yeah, what the thought is. Yeah. And so sometimes you can tell it, you'll get a feeling in your body. Sometimes it'll be like the flavor of your mind, the feeling in your mind, like, oh, I feel grouchy, but why do I feel grouchy? Yeah. And then it's like, You think of what happened before, and it's like, oh, so-and-so said this, and I'm actually upset about it. You know, I'm actually angry about it, and that's why I'm grouchy, you know. If I don't stop and look at that, then I'm just grouchy. And then, you know, people say, what's wrong with you? Well, nothing's wrong, or I'm just in a bad mood. But I don't really see that, oh, something happened, like a cat is about to knock over the tablecloth. You can't knock over a tablecloth, Sutra. About to drag the tablecloth off the table, aren't you? Come sit on the table. You look much better as the MGM lion. Okay. Anyway, so, you know, but to just look and checking in, what am I feeling and what happened before that, you know. Sometimes there's just an internal feeling of uneasiness, you know, and instead of saying, oh, that's somebody did that, oh, and blaming them, it's like, okay, that happened, but this is my internal reaction to what happened. There's this uneasy feeling because actually I'm not happy with them. I'm a bit ticked off. Yeah? Okay.
As for lay people, is it for us to judge the needs or wants of the Sangha and community before we give offerings?
Is it, as lay people, is it for you to judge? Okay, what do you mean by judge? Do you mean evaluate in a balanced way, or do you mean judge with a critical mind?
There's a lag, so it will
take. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, maybe I'll answer the question both ways. Okay. Because, sometimes, if you're... No, it would be actually helpful to me to have more information from the person, what they're asking. Okay.
Similar to this one.
Uh-huh.
Certain country, in monastery, they are very poor. So mm-hmm. when you look at it, they need everything.
Basically. Yeah.
So in a sense that you would like to give everything
mm-hmm.
to them as much as possible, then it becomes like, oh, this group of country person coming, we should really like show that we are...
Yeah. Right.
It's tricky.
Yes. Yes.
Bring up the old sheets and pillowcases. Bring up the old tattered shoes. And
yeah. Yeah. That sometimes it does happen. You help some people, and then they get the idea. Oh, everybody from this country is, going to give lots of donations, so we can either look really poor and elicit their sympathy. Or we can be extremely kind hospitable to them so that they'll feel grateful. Yeah, sometimes that happens. Yeah. And sometimes people are just genuinely kind. And sometimes people genuinely are in need. Yeah. But I think it's always good. Whenever you give to any charity, in a monastery or any charity whatsoever, to really check and make sure that, to ask questions about how the money is used, and to see, do they put out an annual report, what does the money get used for, if somebody's just raising money for something, make sure you get a receipt from the organization, so that you know the organization gets the money. Yeah, ask questions about how things are used. Yeah, so I'm not talking about being suspicious, but I'm talking about being wise. Yeah, because if you give something, you want to make sure it gets used in the way that you have given it, or for the purpose that you've given it for. Yeah. And so I think that's the right of the donor to ask. However, you don't want to go to the other extreme and be one of these donors who then tries to control the charity. Yeah, because it will happen. People warned me about that in starting the Abbey. They said sometimes you may get somebody who will give a huge donation and then start telling you how to run the Abbey. Don't fall for that. Yeah. So, in each situation, you have to see. Yeah?
The person said they meant like to weigh or to evaluate.
To weigh or evaluate. Okay, so, is this the Sangha is asking you for something, or you're just looking and thinking what they need?
Yeah, looking and thinking what they need.
Okay, so if, you're in some place and you're with a Sangha community, then, if you can look and see, what you think they need, it can sometimes be wise to talk with somebody in the community. It depends, what kind of gift you're thinking to offer, how much, you're offering, and so on. It can be good to say, does the community need this? You know, and they may say yes or they may say no. Or you may say, you know, I would like to give, you know, X amount. What is the best way, you know, talk to the abbot or abbess and say what does the community most need? You know, so either of these ways you can do it. Is that what the person was asking? Yeah? You think? Okay. Because I know, for example, that's why I'm saying, like, asking sometimes, you know, do you need this or do you need that? So I remember many years ago, somebody said, I want to get you a television. And I said, well, that's a very kind intention, but actually I don't want a television, you know, because it's very distracting and it takes up time and I don't really enjoy offering it. But I want you to have a television, you know. And I had to say, really, please, you know, for me a television would only be a burden. And I said, how about, you know, I forget what I said exactly. If I said, get this, some other group a television, or if I said, I might have very well said, how about giving the money and I'll give it to some of the Tibetan nuns, you know. And they said, no, I don't want to do that. I want you to have a TV. You know, so please, in your wish to please, don't force somebody to have something, you know, or don't force a community to have something that you think they should have, especially if they think that it's going to take them away from their Dharma practice. Okay. Yeah. But sometimes, you know, it's good, just good to ask, you know, what is needed. Yeah. And then they tell you, or sometimes they say, well, we don't need anything right now, but if you want to, you know, give a donation, then we'll keep it in unrestricted funds. And then when we need to do some maintenance work or, you know, whatever kind of thing, then we'll use it for that.
Mm-hmm. So the first Dharma class I attended, all the students were like, oh, teacher, what do you need, what do you need? And he would say, oh, please offer me an hour of meditation a day.
Yes, I know, that's what you want to say. It's like, yeah, please, yeah, please offer me your meditation practice. I'm like, oh, no, that's not what I meant. Yeah. I'll shop for you for a half an hour in the department store, but I don't want to sit for a half an hour in the cushion. Okay. Any more about that? We'll go on. 22. Not dispelling the three types of laziness. Okay. Sloth, attraction to negative actions, and self-pity and discouragement. So we'll skip that one, too. Okay, but... not the three types of laziness, yeah? So not dispelling them. So sloth, you know, this is the mind, you know, I'll do it later. I don't feel like doing it now. I'm too tired. I've worked so hard. I need a rest. Yeah? So that kind of mind? Yeah. And then the second one, it's a form of laziness, but what it is it's keeping yourself being the busiest of the busy, doing all sorts of useless worldly actions. Okay? So this one, you don't think of yourself as being lazy because you're so busy. You're writing emails, you know, and you are checking this and you are checking that and you are making this list and making that list. And talking to this person and talking to that person and going out with this person because they're a little bit depressed and going out with that person because they're a little bit angry and going to see, you know, somebody just had a baby and you got to see the baby and somebody else just got a kitty and you want to see the kitty and somebody else got a pet pig. You've never seen somebody with a pet pig. You've got to go there. And then you have to go shopping, you know, and get all these different things because... You know, I mean, you've got to get presents for your family members, of course. And you've got to go here and there. And, you know, and then you go out to lunch and you gossip a little bit, just a little bit, you know, we're just kind of seeing how people are. So we just kind of catch up, you know. And 2 hours later, after you've gossiped about this person and that person ad infinitum, you know, then you go on to do some other, you know, go on to the movies, and then you go bowling, or you play miniature golf, or, you know, you go shopping again because you forgot what you needed to get last time you went. Okay, so keeping yourself the busy is the busy, you know, loving to do useless activities. Okay, and then the third one is self-pity and discouragement. So that's interesting, isn't it, that that's a form of discouragement, a form of laziness, you know. I'm so bad, nobody loves me. Oh, they're all friends here, but nobody loves me, and I'm such a horrible Dharma practitioner. I probably deserve it, it's my karma after all. There's nothing I can do. Anyway, the path is too hard. The goal's too high. I can't become a Buddha. They say I can, but what do they know? You know. Everybody else can do it. I'm just a catastrophe. We associate that's laziness. But the second two, we usually don't think about as being laziness. But why are they laziness? Because they take us away from our Dharma practice. They become our own internal mental excuse for not doing our practice. Yeah? Don't they? My little toe hurts so badly. Oh, you can't imagine. I don't think I can continue teaching the class. My little toe hurts. Okay. Then the next one, 23. With attachment, spending time idly talking and joking. We're gonna skip that one too. Okay, but yeah, with attachment, you know, spending time idly talking and joking, and then saying, "But I don't have any time." Yeah, this is what you hear around here all the time. I don't have any time, but I always have time to sit and yak a bit. Yeah, talk, joke. Right?
I think for us lay people who are from out of texting, must include texting.
Oh yeah, definitely texting. Yeah, I mean, well, that's part of your hand already. It's you know, grown. It's you can't get it out of your hand. Yeah, it's attached.
Attachment.
Yeah, definitely attached. Yeah, we see that sometimes when people come here to stay because we collect their electronic devices. They look at us, you know, with this sense of horror. You want my smartphone? Today's Friday and you're not going to give it back to me until Sunday? You know.
Yesterday, then, for a 3-day retreat, and wanted to know when she'd get onto her laptop each day.
Yeah. And so, you know, we try and tell people, you know, be where your body is. Your body is here. Don't go online. Don't use your phone. Yeah. Because it's a distraction. Yeah. Stay here. Keep your mind where your body is. We had, during one of the winter retreats one time, you know, as you know, not everybody keeps the discipline during winter retreats.
What?
So, this one woman, you know, she thought she was being real clever, you know, because no telephone, no iPad, anything, you know. So, what was it? Did she use our phone? Or maybe she had another cell phone or something. No, I think she used our phone. And she just said to herself, I just have to, you know, check the messages on my thing. So as it turns out, in the middle of the retreat, she gets very upset, you know, and she's so upset. And why are you so upset? Well, you know, I used the telephone, which was, you know, not according to retreat discipline. And I called to check my messages. And I've been going out with this married man. And he left a message telling me that he's going out with somebody else now. And that we're done. You know? And it's like, well, if you didn't break the retreat discipline, you wouldn't know that the married man that you're dating is cheating on you. And, you know, we didn't say this to her, but we thought it, you know. And maybe you want to think again about dating married men. It might. You know, there's the five precepts. Remember those? You took them last time you were here. Okay? So there is a reason for the discipline that we keep at the retreat. Yeah. Okay. Were you here that time? Yeah? Do you remember that? We could do some really good skits about what happens on retreat. Come on, laugh. Okay, then, to eliminate obstacles. So these three about joyous effort, there's three of them, but they're all really difficult, aren't they? Yeah, do you think they're difficult?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? And yet, how important they are, so that we can stay on track and do what we really want to do in the depths of our heart. Yeah, without getting distracted by all the nonsense in our mind. Okay, then next one, to eliminate obstacles to the far-reaching attitude of meditative stability. So 24, not seeking the means to develop concentration, such as proper instructions and the right conditions necessary to do so, not practicing the instructions once one has received them. Okay? So this doesn't mean that you make concentration your chief practice, but it means that you should seek to get the proper instructions about how to develop concentration and seek to have good conditions to meditate in. Yeah, because if you don't, then trying to develop concentration isn't going to work because you need certain external conditions. And once you have the instructions and the conditions, then not practicing the instructions. Okay? So we can see how that's something to abandon. And then 25, not abandoning the five obscurations, or these are the five hindrances, actually. The five hindrances which hinder meditative stability. So excitement and regret. Yeah, so excitement is attachment, looking forward to some nice thing. Yeah, regret is feeling here, in the sense it's feeling like, oh, I should have done that, but I didn't, or I did that and I shouldn't have, you know, so this kind of mind that's quite stuck in the past. Usually, you know, regretting our negativities is a virtuous action. Yeah, regretting our virtuous actions is a destructive action. But sometimes just this, oh, I did this and I shouldn't have, and I didn't do that and I should have, and that just, you know, takes up a lot of time and energy. Okay, so that's one. Harmful thought is, you know, sitting in our meditation, planning our revenge because everybody treats us unfairly. Okay, then sleep and dullness, so falling asleep in your sessions, or your mind just getting heavy and dull. Then sensual desire, having lots of desire for sense objects, daydreaming a lot. And then doubt, like, oh, does this technique really work? Can I do it? Can't I do it? Is this worthwhile doing? So that two-pointed mind that again impedes us. Yeah? So the thing is here to notice when we have any of these five hindrances in our mind, to notice them, and then to apply the antidotes to them. Okay? Then 26, seeing the good qualities of the taste of meditative stability and becoming attached to it. So when you practice and you start getting some good concentration, you know, or you attain serenity or whatever, then it's very easy, they say, to get quite attached to the very blissful, you know, rapturous experience of it, and then not continuing to develop your analytical wisdom, but just liking to kind of get spaced out in your concentration. Okay, so those are the three pertaining to meditative stability. And then to eliminate obstacles to the far-reaching practice of wisdom, then 27 is abandoning the Pali scriptures or practices described in them as unnecessary for one practicing the Mahayana. So this again, like we talked about this last week too, people not understanding properly what the Pali tradition is, what the Mahayana tradition is, and so thinking like Mahayana is completely different than the fundamental vehicle practices, but actually you have to do the fundamental vehicle practices to get anywhere at all on the Mahayana. Okay? So this is like saying, oh, but you know, in the fundamental vehicle they talk about having good ethical conduct, you know, keeping the five precepts. But that's such a baby waby practice. I don't need to do that. I follow the Mahayana. I'm doing this for the benefit of all sentient beings. So it's not so bad if I drink or lie or any of these things. It's for the benefit of others. Okay? So thinking, you know, that you don't need to do these kind of practices because you're somehow superior when you're not. Okay, 28, exerting effort principally in another system of practice while neglecting the one that you already have. Okay, which is the Mahayana. So, you know, you start, maybe, you know, you're really interested in interfaith dialogue or in inter-Buddhist dialogue, so you start learning about other religions, you start learning about different kinds of Buddhism, and then all of a sudden your mind goes, oh, wow, that looks really good, that kind of practice is really great, and you get attracted to something else. Yeah, that's going to take you away from bodhicitta and take you away from trying to gain the wisdom realizing emptiness. Okay, so doing that. Yeah. Okay, that, so you can see that there's some balance needed in here. We need to do the practices of the fundamental vehicle, yeah, but we also need to do them and do them with a bodhicitta motivation so that we keep our Mahayana practice. Okay? 29, without a good reason, exerting effort to learn or practice the treatises of non-Buddhists, which are not proper objects of one's endeavor. Okay, so sometimes, like especially in ancient India, when they had all these debates, you had to learn the tenets of different systems so that you can debate with them. But here, you know, you're learning their tenets. You know, first you start out, you know, with a specific reason, or, you know, you're going to go to an interfaith dialogue, so you need to read something about the other religions so you know what kind of questions to ask. Yeah, but then again, you start getting distracted by that, and without a good reason to learn those things, you just start reading, you know, I want to read all these books about this and all these books about that, and then pretty soon, you know, you've lost your practice and you've gone into something else. Okay. And then 30, beginning to favor and take delight in the treatises of non-Buddhists, although studying them for a good reason. So you're studying them, you know, because you need to learn and, you know, learn how to debate different things and to discuss different things. But then you start thinking, the Samkhya tradition or, you know, some New Age tradition, they talk about one universal consciousness. That sounds really nice. I like that idea. Because then we're all one. We're all related. There's one universal consciousness. You know? And so you start adopting the tenets of, you know, some kind of wrong view or another. Okay? So you start out studying them with a good reason, get waylaid. 31, abandoning any part of the Mahayana by thinking it is uninteresting or unpleasant. You know Shantideva, chapter 8. Yeah, he talks about equalizing and exchanging self and others, and that part of the chapter is really good. But the first part of the chapter, he talks all about how disgusting the body is and how to overcome sexual desire. And you know, that's just yucky. You know, I don't want to sit there and think of how disgusting my body is and how disgusting my partner's body is. Do you know, some years ago, I won't say where, but someplace in America, people invited His Holiness to teach Chapter 8, and they asked him not to teach that part of Chapter 8. I can't believe it. How do you ask His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, not to teach part of what is written in Shantideva? He taught it anyway. I was horrified. Can you imagine seeing that?
What was their reaction?
Well, it was a big group, you know, so... I think then they had some panels and, you know, well, we got to explain this and this and this and that, and it really doesn't mean this and blah, 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 you know. And then there was one monk, Achanamara, was on the panel, and he said, no, it means exactly what it says. Okay, 32, praising oneself or belittling others because of pride, anger, and so forth. So that's like one of the first ones. Yeah, so one of the root ones, the first one, was praising oneself or belittling others because of attachment to receiving material offerings, praise, and respect. Okay, so that's the motivation for the root precept. For this secondary one, praising oneself or belittling others because of pride, anger, and so forth. So not out of attachment to getting offerings or getting respect or having a bunch of groupies, you know, following you around, you know, but doing this because, you know, you just think you're the greatest fantastic, you know, Dharma practitioner around. Or maybe you're angry at somebody else who, or jealous at somebody else who is better than you in some way, and you have to belittle them. Yeah, you're in competition with the teacher from the local Dharma, the Dharma center next door. Yeah? And you heard they said something bad about you, so now you're going to put them down. OK? Okay. Then 33 is not going to Dharma gatherings or teachings. Yeah. So this means, like, I mean, of course, if you're sick, if you have some important work for the Sangha and there's no other time to do it, yeah, then you miss Dharma gatherings and teachings. But this is, you know, you're healthy, you're well, yeah, but you just don't feel like going to teachings. You know, and I don't feel like going to that puja. That puja just takes too long. You know, and those teachings, she says all the same jokes that I've been hearing for years, you know. Oh, I'm glad you're laughing. Yeah, but, you know, so just, you know, out of laziness, out of arrogance, I've heard that teaching before, I don't need to hear it again. Mm-hmm. Yeah, or this text is really boring, or, you know, whatever it is. You know, so we should really make an effort when we can to go to Dharma teachings and Dharma gatherings. That doesn't mean when you're sick, you know, and you're going to infect everybody there that you drag yourself to a teaching. Yeah. But sometimes if you feel a little bit sick, my experience has been, if you feel a little bit not well, and you go to a teaching, you go to puja, I feel much better afterwards. Yeah. Okay, so some kind of laziness, arrogance, whatever, just, you know, losing interest in the Dharma, basically. Yeah, losing care about these things. Then 34, despising the spiritual master or the meaning of the teachings and relying instead on their mere words. That is, if a teacher does not express him or herself well, you don't try to understand the meaning of what he or she says, but you criticize. Okay? So despising the teaching or the teacher. Yeah. So, and relying on mere words. Okay. So it could be, you know, maybe the teacher is not so articulate. Maybe the teacher, you know, stutters. Maybe the teacher coughs a lot. Maybe the teacher doesn't have a steady flow of words, but they pause for a long time to think of what to say, or, you know, who knows what. They don't crack enough jokes, because, you know, teaching should be entertaining. And this teacher, you know, just reads from the text and, you know, same old thing. Yeah, and you want some entertainment. All this kind of stuff. You know, who are we harming by not going to teachings? Yeah, or by disliking the teacher. And I should say here, sometimes too, you know, sometimes we just give up. Oh, this teaching is so advanced, I'll never understand it. So you just sit there and you don't try and understand it. Yeah, you just kind of sign off. Oh, it's too hard. I don't understand it. You know? And you don't try to understand it. You don't try to listen. Yeah? I mean, I know from listening to hours of teachings in Tibetan without any translation, yeah, that I had to keep myself interested. So I would try and listen, you know, just to see if there were certain sounds or phrases or words, or I would look at the teacher's, you know, body language or whatever. Yeah. So, you know, you try and stay engaged somehow. But I don't think many of you have sat through teachings in Tibetan where you didn't understand the language. So.
Teachings in Chinese where you didn't understand the language.
Yeah. Yeah. That too. Yeah. Okay. But, you know, criticizing and, yeah. So, you know, when we criticize the Dharma teacher, the criticism doesn't hurt the teacher, but it certainly hurts us. Because then we tune out. Yeah, we tune out, then we're the ones who miss out on the teaching. Okay. Any questions? Yeah. Okay.
first is we could go to teachings of other teachers of the same tradition and lineage, but we don't because we want to stick with one teacher. Is that okay?
Yeah, what I'm saying here, do I need to repeat the question so everybody hears, they can hear? Okay, that I'm not saying that every time there's any teaching, you have to run off to a teaching, because sometimes you need to meditate, sometimes you're in retreat, sometimes you need to study. If you're doing some other Dharma activity, you know, or, if it's your own teacher, it's good to go. If it's another teacher who isn't your teacher, there's no obligation at all for you to go, you know. If even it's the same tradition or whatever, yeah. If it's a time where you feel like, okay, I need to sit and study right now and I need to think about the teachings right now, and you don't go for that reason, that's fine. But if you don't go because, you know, there's something really good on TV, yeah. So it doesn't mean that you have to go to absolutely every teaching that's given in the town, because, you know, in some places there's so many teachings all the time. And so it's not talking about that. But, you know, it's like when you've been attending a series of regular teachings, you know, then just not going. Or you've been following a teacher and then, you know, that teacher, you know, comes to where you are, but you don't feel like going. Yeah. So these kind of things. Yeah. If you've been studying with somebody, you know, then you should, if they're a resident teacher, you know, try and go. You may pick, you don't have to go to every class they're teaching. You pick the class you want to, but go on a regular basis. If you're following a teacher that lives somewhere else that you don't get to see so often, you know, when they come to where you are, go. That's not the time for you to, you know, go do something else. Yeah. You know, or if you go somewhere else to attend teachings, once you get there, then don't say, oh, but I'm also on holiday, so I feel like going to the movies instead tonight. Yeah. Okay. Does that answer the question okay?
Is even without the conditions for developing meditative stability, what are the best ways to improve our concentration?
Okay. To learn how to do meditative stability and to practice them the best they can in whatever situation you're in. There's no other instruction besides that. You know, even if you don't have the perfect conditions, yeah, that doesn't mean that you entirely have a totally different way of meditating. It just, you follow the instructions as best as you can given the condition that you're in. Okay? But the thing is that it's important to do things on a regular basis, you know? It's better do something a little bit every day than a lot one day and nothing for the next 5 days. Something like that. Mm-hmm.
Is it wrong to go to a specific initiation by another teacher and then never return after the initiation?
Is it wrong to go to a specific initiation by another teacher and then never return? When you take an initiation from somebody, that person becomes one of your Dharma teachers. Yeah? So they become one of your Dharma teachers. So the assumption is that you've checked them out, you think that they're a reliable teacher, you want to learn from them. Yeah? And so you may start out with that, but, you know, the idea is that you, they're one of your teachers. Okay, I strongly advise against taking initiation from somebody that you've never had any Dharma connection with before whatsoever, that you've never heard a teaching from, you know. And if, you know, if it's just, how to say, If it's some initiation that you really want to take because you sincerely want to do that practice, yeah, and somebody is coming to where you are, you know from checking with your own teacher that person is a reliable spiritual mentor and your teacher's in favor of you taking this initiation and you know you want to do the practice, then yes, go take that initiation, you know. But don't just treat that teacher like, okay, got the initiation, bye, never want to speak to you again. You know, in the initiation, you see that person as the emanation of the deity. You're establishing a very strong dharma link with them. So it's extremely important before you take initiation from somebody that you check out the qualities of that person. And that's why I think, you know, you should, you know, go to teachings, listen to their teachings, check out, kind of, you know, learn about them, learn about what they're teaching, learn about their tradition. Yeah, not to be a, you know, just kind of
shopping.
Yeah, shopping. Yeah.
You're going to a restaurant.
Yeah, like going to a restaurant. Oh, they have a sale on, you know, on pizza today. Let's go have Italian food at this pizzeria, and then we never go back there. That's not the way you treat a Dharma teacher. Okay? I mean, people do treat Dharma teachers like that, but that does not help your practice if you do that. Yeah, because then you're just using somebody, aren't you? Okay, anything else? So that's why, you know, in the modern age, it's like people come to town on Friday, give highest yoga tantra initiation Saturday and Sunday, and leave on Monday. I really disagree with that. Yeah? Because it's establishing a very, you know, deep connection when you take initiation with somebody, and you should, you know something about that teacher before and want them to be our teacher, and we should want to do the practice. We're not just taking the initiation because, well, that's what you do, and so has so many initiations, and I want to have just as many initiations as they do. Yeah, it's not a good reason. Mm-hmm.
If someone wants to return to the whole question of wrong view,
uh-huh.
So he asks, would it be considered wrong view if a person thinks that sometimes it's necessary to kill or go to war? So for example, Hitler. Then he would have killed many more people in the concentration camps.
Mm-hmm.
Is it wrong view if someone thinks it's necessary to go to war? Yes. And then the person says they're always confused about the example of the Buddha killing the captain of a ship in his previous life.
Right, okay. So is it wrong view to think it's sometimes necessary to go to war?
Oh, and what he meant was like, if to stop someone like Hitler, people justify it going to war for that reason.
Okay, so something's happened, so is it sometimes justified to go to war to stop somebody who's doing a lot of negative, or a party that's doing a lot of negativity and harming a lot of people in order to stop them? I remember once this kind of question came, you know, asked to His Holiness, and the person kind of said, in other words, is war sometimes like a necessary evil? And His Holiness said, necessary evil. I mean, what could he say?
Mm.
Yeah, but he very much resonated. Yeah, it sometimes can be a necessary evil. But that doesn't mean it's good to do. But on the other hand, you know, in Tibet, they tried to fight off the invasion as best as they could. Yeah. I mean, there were people who had guns. The problem was they didn't have a big military. Otherwise, if they had a military, they would have probably fought. But that's not a question, really, I can answer that I feel comfortable answering. Yeah.
What about, how is it different from what the Buddha did in the past?
Okay, so the story about the Buddha as the captain of the ship, you know, the Buddha was a bodhisattva. Okay, it's different when a bodhisattva kills than when an ordinary person does it. Yeah, Because a bodhisattva is like they've really looked at the situation and they know through clairvoyance what's going to happen, you know, what could happen. And they really have compassion for everybody in the situation. Yeah, so that's a special kind of situation. For us, you know, we don't necessarily have that kind of clairvoyance, and, you know, most of us don't, and we wind up being angry. Yeah, so... Yeah, so there is a difference between ordinary beings doing something and bodhisattvas doing something. Okay? Mm-hmm.
It seems like throughout history, every war has been presented as a just war by the people that are perpetuating it. And so it's very...
Isn't that interesting?
What do we know about the people we go to war with? We know what we've been told about the people that want us to go to war.
Yeah. Yeah, that throughout history, war has been justified very often on religious grounds. You know, we are defending God, we are defending Buddha, we're defending the right side. Yeah, and it's really difficult to tell when that is true and when that isn't true. And even if it is true, still, you know, are there other ways to deal with the situation besides going to war? Yeah.
I might understand, not very clear, but those people who defend go to war for God for whatever, mm-hmm. right side and so on, and we will go heaven even we die. Whereas Bodhisattva at that moment, he see it that he know he will go to hell.
Yes.
He's okay.
Yes.
Because if he kill one,
very good point.
Save the 500 people.
Yeah.
And he is willing to take upon himself and not, I kill you, I go to heaven.
Right.
I think that is a...
That's a very good point. Thank you. Okay. So in case people didn't hear it, she's saying, in the example of the Buddha with the boat, you know, killing the one person, the Buddha was completely willing to go to hell in order to save the lives of these people and in order to keep that one person from creating so much negative karma. Whereas other people, they will go to war thinking that they will go to heaven because of going to war. You know? So it's a big difference thinking that you're going to go to heaven because you're on the right side, being willing, then it's a big difference between that and thinking, you know, I'm willing to go to hell for the benefit of others. Mm-hmm.
His Holiness also says that the way the planet, everybody on the planet is so interconnected now with the global society that war is obsolete and dialogue
yeah.
is necessary.
Yeah, completely. And you can see how he says war is old-fashioned. And it is, you know, very old-fashioned. Okay, so we'll finish this, the Bodhisattva Dash next week.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase. Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamiryatayami.
Due to this merit, may we soon
attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow, May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore in the snowy mountain pure land. You're the source of good and happiness, powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezi. May you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Atravasti Abbey in the West Flores.